Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. As it just so happens, we are recording here in, December 7th? We're going to publish this episode shortly. Last night, I was at a climate change talk, and one of the subjects was ocean acidification. And lo and behold, Craig Pittman's latest column in the Florida Phoenix is all about that scary, scary topic.
It is. And it's, you know, it's one that hardly anybody knows about. I mean, we know, oh, yeah, the world's getting warmer. Oh, yeah, we can see the sea is creeping up higher. But what people don't realize is that the ocean has been absorbing a lot of the carbon dioxide we're producing. And that alters the ocean chemistry and makes it more acidic, which is really bad for shellfish. It's bad for limestone. It's eating away, basically eating away at our coast and messing up our seafood industry. And
it's bad for shellfish because the actual shell is,
carbonate.
Carbonate, right. Yeah. And with the ocean more acidic, the animals can't create the shell. This is shrimp. This is oysters. But more importantly, it's krill. It's plankton. It is the basis of the food chain in the ocean that is collapsing because of the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, which is getting into the water, which is causing the acidification of the ocean. And if you didn't know, Florida on three sides has salt water.
Yeah. And the, you know, the scientists say, hey, this is happening now. This is not some prediction. This is happening now. We're seeing it.
You can measure the pH in the water. Yeah. I mean, this is like reading a thermometer. This is not theory.
And we've got state officials who are like, oh, climate change, that's just politicization of the weather. Mm-hmm. And it's a bunch of left-wing stuff and we're not paying attention to it. And just last month, the head of the DOT wrote to the feds and said, I'm not going to take your money to try and work on cutting back tailpipe emissions because you're politicizing the roads and we're just going to build roads. We're not going to politicize it. It's like, why would you want to stop an effort to reduce pollution from cars? I mean, that's just crazy. But
saying the catalytic converter is politicized. You know, I like acid rain. Air pollution is one of the leading causes of death in the world every single year. People don't realize it's absurd on its face, of course. And ocean acidification, particularly here in Florida, is another piece of that puzzle. Of a scary, scary future without all of these crustaceans that we not only eat, but everything else in the ocean eats.
Exactly.
FloridaPhoenix.com. We have had a stretch of fantastic episodes here, Craig, candidly. Scarface last week, the Goliath grouper, Kingsley Plantation. I mean, some of these lately have been all-timers, and we have another one today. Our guest is Mackenzie Funk, and he has written a book about this character, Hank Asher, a Florida man who I'm guessing 99% of the people listening to this right now have never heard of.
Yeah. When I wrote my book, Oh Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country, I wish I had known about Hank Asher because he would have been a number one example for the way Florida influences not just the rest of the country, but the rest of the world.
Deeply, profoundly, in ways you can't imagine that we will get into. This episode touches on Florida sunshine laws, which we've done an episode on, Bush and Gore in 2000, the numerous cocaine episodes of South Florida in the late 70s, early 80s. It really could go on and on and on and on. This episode links so many of them together. The book just published fall of 2023, The Hank Show, How a House Painting, Drug Running, DEA Informant Built the Machine That Rules Our Lives. The author, Mackenzie Funk.
Mackenzie, thanks so much for joining us today. This book is absolutely fascinating. How did you first find out about the most important Florida man that nobody's ever heard of?
I'm on the diagonal part of the country in Washington State. So it wasn't through talking to people in Florida at the onset. I got a call from a magazine editor. I'm a magazine journalist by trade most of the time. And he wanted to do something on this group of vigilantes who were catching child predators. And long story short, that story I didn't want to do turned out to be a boondoggle. You've probably seen the scandals around this very same group who are based in Utah in recent years. And I decided I didn't want to do that. But as I was looking at their website, I saw a reference to the fact that they use this software donated by the company founded by the father of data fusion, Hank Asher. And I said, why have I never heard of this guy? And so I started searching for his name, and he died a few years before this all happened. He died in 2013. This is probably 2015 that I was doing all this. And honestly, the thing that got me was reading what people wrote about him on legacy.com and on the website they set up in memorial for the man. You know, everyone says something nice about somebody when they die, but what they said about him was it was weird. He stopped terrorists. He paid for my dental work. He paid for my son's college. He would call me in the middle of the night. And so he just seemed like a very full character. And this, at this moment, was the moment where the term big data was in vogue. We were starting to think about what computers could do. And here was this person who turned out had built a lot of this stuff far before anyone was paying attention. So I just kind of got sucked in.
All right. Before we go any further, what is data fusion, which is what is going to be his greatest legacy, and maybe not the most colorful. Certainly, we'll get into some of that stuff. But as far as impact on everyone in the world, really, what is data fusion, and how does he connect to that?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think I didn't know that either. But the way they used it in his companies. Data fusion was taking these disparate data sets, say all the listings in the phone company with all the records from the Department of Highway Safety, all the driver's license registrations, and somehow finding a way to combine that to make it that you could attach all these different data points that you got at all these different sources or from all these different sources to a single entity, which is in this case a single person. So it's fusing all this information you get from all these different places into one sort of combined spot.
Was it an algorithm? Was it software? What did he develop that was unique to allow his companies to do this?
Yeah. So what Hank Asher did to create data fusion was a few things. One, he simply asked for data sets that no one else had. No one else had tried to get every driver's license from the state of Florida. And so that was an innovation in the sense that nobody was that audacious. That was part of it. But he also created a computer system big enough to sort it all. And he did this through combining a bunch of PCs. And I hadn't realized before starting this project that the IBM PC was born in Florida, that it was born there in what's now Blue Lake Center in Boca Raton. And it was built in private there and then launched in 1985. So as Asher in the 80s was beginning to teach himself how to use computers, he was taking these very basic PCs and combining them into basically a DIY supercomputer. And that was not easy. It was a coordination problem, getting all these little processors to talk to each other. It's pretty common in our data centers now. It is the cloud more or less works like this. That was the next thing. And the final and most difficult thing was an algorithm or series of algorithms that basically said, this piece goes with this person. And yes, that was an algorithm or a series of inventions. And eventually, his companies would assign a tracking number to each of us individually. Ooh. One of them is now known as the Lex ID. It's like a shadow social security number. And that was a way to basically give each of us a barcode and keep track of us. A SKU number as we move through the system and attach different data points to us. But just figuring out that this Chad Scott is the same as that other Chad Scott in the database is not an easy problem. And it's not just one factor, but a series of them. And what exactly these were was proprietary and still hidden, and it's still ever evolving. But we can think of it in a simple way. It has to do with a shared address history with some other person. If two Chad Scotts live with this other person two times, you can sort of figure out that they're the same. Of course, date of birth, where they've lived, consistent phone number, eventually all these things that would just sort of show a continuity of person. And they wrote a ton of algorithms to figure out how to really connect how to link these data sets. So they pull in new data sets from usually from public records and then find a way to attach them to these individuals.
Now, Hank was a sort of an unlikely figure to be involved in this kind of stuff, to put it mildly. How did he come to computer? What did he do before he did computers?
He moved to Florida at age 18 from the Chicago area. That was after dropping out of high school and becoming a house painter. And one of the reasons he moved to Florida was that you could paint houses year round. It wasn't like the weather up in Chicago. You could work all the time. And he got down there and he saw all these condo towers going up, the tombstone towers. And he saw an opportunity. And so as those condo towers went up, he became the painter who painted them all. And his company, eventually hundreds of people, 200-300 was the biggest in South Florida. And so by age 25, he was a multimillionaire. Mm. And he lived the life of a somewhat wild young millionaire, lots of drinking, some drugs, lots of partying. He taught himself, he took flying lessons. He got a small plane and he fell in love with the Bahamas. And he also fell in with a group of people who were flying to and from the Bahamas and to and from Latin America quite a lot because they were cocaine smugglers. And stories differ as to how intentionally he fell in with this group. But my reporting, I think he knew very well who they were and what they were doing. He was no dummy. He bought an Aerostar, which was about the fastest twin-engine plane you could get. And he bought it because that's what this whole group, they called themselves a gang, that's what they used. And pretty soon he was a member of this smuggling gang. And he was both a pilot for them, flying loads of pot first and then coke into Florida. And eventually he was running his own operations, it looks like. He was moving money up and down through Florida. It was mainly trying to get, as the drug war moved and kind of blocked southern Florida, it became a logistical problem because you couldn't fly a plane all the way from Columbia to North Florida where the airstrips were less observed, I would say. And so he found a way station that happened to be in Belize that would allow them to stop and refuel and then go onward. And so he was, like in the painting business, he had a very good logistical mind. And so he was solving logistical problems for this smuggling gang.
Interesting. What is the movie that closely follows that synopsis of a guy who, to whatever extent, becomes kind of a private?
With Tom Cruise in it, yeah. Asher's daughters had me watch that movie when it came out. They were really excited. They're like, I think this is sort of like what Dad was doing. It's true. There were stories that Asher not only worked as a cocaine smuggler, but that he did things for the CIA.
American Made is the name of the film.
American Made, exactly.
And it is, again, a hotshot young guy, and he flies into these makeshift airstrips across Florida during the early days of the drug trade and becomes fabulously wealthy, but then gets caught up in this whole thing. So it is a really good film. So continue. I'm sorry, because you were getting into another fascinating aspect with his connection to the CIA.
I was, of course, obsessed with this chapter of his life, and in part because, as we'll probably discuss, it really infected what he was able to do with this technology he built. It became this albatross that he always carried with him, that he'd had this cocaine smuggler past. And there were all sorts of stories about what he'd actually done, how culpable he'd been, if he'd been a small player, a big player. And so I spent a lot of time trying to understand really who he'd run with and what he'd done. And I couldn't pin down. There was this persistent rumor in FDLE reports and elsewhere that he had worked with the CIA, or at least thought he was working with the CIA. And what he said was that, no, I'd agreed to go down to Nicaragua and get some, land on the airstrip and get some of our people who were down there and then fly them back. That was it. Others said he was involved in an assassination plot and recruiting them for that. It was never really clear which of those things it was, or if it was all just a smokescreen, because the way he got out of trouble with both the DEA and the FDLE was that when he retired from painting, he retired to the Bahamas, and he happened to become very good friends with his neighbor, F. Lee Bailey, the famous attorney. Jeez. And Bailey basically cut him a deal. He cut him a deal with the DEA to not really inform on his gang, but to be their eyes on the ground on Great Harbor Key in the Berry Islands, and to get this group of observers to try to shut down the transshipments there, because it's so close, of course, to the coast that you could land there and take the product by boat. And so they really wanted to shut down Great Harbor Key. They hadn't done it. And here they had Asher, who was tied to all these people on the island. So that was his get out of jail free card. F. Lee Bailey, I talked to him before his death. He did whisper something to me. He had me turn off my voice recorder and say, "You heard about the CIA stuff, right?" And I said, "Yeah, tell me more." He's like, "Well, I can't, but you heard about that, right?" And I was like, "Okay." Some people thought that this was F. Lee Bailey spinning a tale to get him out of trouble, that he went to the DEA and said, "Look, here's this guy. He's helped out the CIA a little bit. He's willing to help shut down the Berries." And I was never able to detangle which of those it really was. Even after long after Asher's death, Bailey was suggesting that it was real.
Did that relate to him deciding to get into computers, or was that just him trying basically finding a new obsession?
As I wrote in the book, there was something about Florida that he seemed to rely on whatever the native economy was at the time. Huh. Condo towers were going up. He's a house painter. Cocaine was getting smuggled in. He became a smuggler. And there was a real pocket around Boca of people in the data business. At the same time, Asher had seen the inner workings of the DEA as he was working as an informant. And he himself had called up this El Paso, the central computer. The DEA had this computer that was like none other among federal agencies, very advanced for its time, that was called NADIS. And it basically assigned tracking numbers to all these people who were suspected of being involved in the drug trade. And they would just kind of record everything in this big database, and it was kept in the supercomputer in El Paso. And Asher was eventually, I don't know how he did this, he was eventually radioing in information and calling the home phone numbers of the guys who ran the NADIS computer. So he very well knew that these little bits of information, these little tidbits, were being sent to a big central computer somewhere, and that was seen as very important to the drug trade, or I'm sorry, to the counter drug mission. And so I think that those things could both be true. He was both in a place where there was this explosion with the PC, and where there was a sort of a marketing list, marketing driven economy in Boca, and where the PC had been born. And he'd also seen that the government would really want this too. And that was one of his big innovations. He didn't compile data to sell you a toaster. He compiled it to sell to cops and insurance companies. That was something new.
It's amazing. You say he's a high school dropout. So this is not someone with an engineering degree, a computer science degree, anything like this. Obviously a brilliant individual, ambitious risk taker, the ability to spot opportunities, probably a smooth talker to fall in with some of the people he did and survive. What kind of a guy was he? What kind of a guy was he to hang out with? Was he married? Did he have kids? Did he have a lot of friends? Was he a loner? Who was Hank Asher the person?
That is a very good question, because I got wildly different answers from everyone he talked to. I think everyone I talked to would agree that he was someone who wanted to be at the center of things. That he was aggressive when he was young, sometimes physically, but very competitive. He very much wanted to win, and he wanted to leave his mark in some way. That was always the case. So he always needed to be at the center of things. The title of the book is derived from what a friend said about him, is that a family friend would said it was better than watching TV. They would just come over and watch the Hank show, because he took up all the oxygen in a room. He was loud. He was funny. He was absolutely quick. He was just, so people would just come in and laugh. He was really charismatic. You're right. People said he had the gift of the gab, but he was mercurial. He was very angry. He could yell at somebody. and then he would feel bad and buy them a car. That was the thing he did at his early companies. He would just chew somebody out, and then he'd feel bad, and the next day he'd have bought them a car. And it was this this up and down. Eventually, he was very generous, but in truth, everyone I talked to said he was sort of unknowable. And if I said what made him tick, people gave me very different answers. Some said, no, he wasn't motivated by money, which is borne out by the fact that he gave a lot of it away. But he was seemingly motivated by power, and maybe most of all, by a need to prove himself. He did not come from an easy background. His family had money, but his father was abusive. That was part of him leaving home and part of wanting to prove himself. He was the odd duck in a somewhat prominent family, and who was told he would never amount to anything.
Oh.
And so he was driven from that moment on to perhaps prove his dad wrong and then prove everybody wrong who had written him off. And perhaps after his stint as a smuggler, that became even stronger. And it became prove himself to the cops who thought he was a bad guy. But he was, I would say he was exhausting to be around. He would get into these manias. He would stay up for 3 days in a row. Someone said he was like a dog with a bone when he had a problem. He wouldn't ever let it go. This was with computers, but I think with everything. And he would sometimes fall off and have these moments of maybe depression or where he was removed from things. Some of the cops who were there when he was caught for smuggling, some of the drug investigators, eventually worked for him and with him. And they were sometimes the best observers of him because they'd seen him for so long. And they also, sure, they got paid well, but they were at the heart. They were investigators. They were observers of people. And one of them told me that they went on a boat trip once. And his wife just had been just watching Asher and just said, look, you can almost see him think. He just won't relax. He was on the satellite phone. He was typing. He was drinking late. He was just constantly in motion. And you could just see sort of the agony, and the drug investigator who at that time was working with him thought he was fundamentally unhappy too. He kind of ran forward because if not, he would be stuck with whatever that was.
His first big computer enterprise involved insurance, right? Specifically motor vehicle records. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The early 90s. So he'd kind of gotten out of his drug trouble in the late 80s, and he immediately, with whatever money he had left over, walked in and got himself a laptop. And then the guy who sold him a laptop agreed to teach him how to use it and literally teach him how to type, teach him how to turn it on, things like that. Eventually, they got into programming, and he turned out to be this person who had a mind for patterns and that obsessive thing that I told you about. Eventually, those two men, the other one's name is Roy Brubaker, founded a company called Database Technologies. And the two of them at first were just taking on whatever programming jobs they could. I think there was one that was like a fruit company for their shipping software and inventory management. But whatever, doctors, lawyers, dentists' offices, they would just take these programming jobs and build stuff. And they had this breakthrough idea to link these PCs together to build that sort of DIY supercomputer I mentioned. And eventually, someone came to them and said, hey, I heard you guys can do database stuff, and I want to take every vehicle registration from the state of Florida and put it in a database. Can you do that? And Asher said, yeah, sure. That man, John Leggett, had been part of this the motor vehicle registration or records trade, which was indeed dominated by insurance companies. And that was just sending records down so insurers could know who you were. And he realized if they built this database, they could streamline things and make a ton of money very quickly. And Asher promised he could do it. And so they basically got these tapes. We're talking rolls of magnetic tape that they drove down from Tallahassee to, I think their office was in Hollywood at the time, or maybe it was in Pompano. And they loaded them up onto this computer and they got it to work. They could build this database that you could query different records. And crucially, you could see who lived with whom. Already at that time, Asher said, great, this is going to be a great product for the insurance companies. And he also saw that cops would really be into it. He went to his old handler, the DEA. They met, I think, at the in the parking lot at the airport, at an executive airport in Lauderdale. And he said, "Hey, if I could build you a computer that just had instant access to public records, do you think the agency would go for that?" His handler said, yeah, probably. And that was absolutely the case. Once they started showing it to cops, even if insurance was the bread and butter, the cops went crazy for it as well.
Why?
It's hard to remember what it was like back then, but it was because he basically built it from the ground up to think like a cop would, like an investigator would, which is the same idea of getting little bits of information, putting them together, and seeing who knows whom, where they've lived, their address history, their relatives, all these things that you can do in a relational database. Phone numbers, of course. Eventually, they added the phone numbers of neighbors so that a detective could call up a neighbor and say, "Hey, have you seen so-and-so at their house lately?" Things like that. So it was these investigations that were just painstaking. It took, for instance, to bust Asher's gang, took the FDLE investigator more than a year just to piece together who was who. And it was going back and getting enough evidence that there were these interesting flights going into this ranch in Okeechobee County to show that maybe we should get a warrant for their phone records. And then going through and getting the phone records from the phone company, which took a bunch of time, and then putting them in this dinosaur of a computer and trying to see patterns in those phone records to see who was calling other people. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of stuff that from public records, if you have marriage records and divorce records and pilot records and driver's license records, you can see if people have lived together 3 times in a row. So they must know each other pretty well, or maybe they're still living together. You can see who someone's sister is or who their mom is. If you're trying to get a fugitive, if you're trying to track down a missing kid, this is the kind of information you can get very quickly. You can see what their license plate is, sure. You can also see what color their car is and where it's been seen in the past. Wow. I mean, all this stuff that you can get like that, you couldn't get before. You could only get it through calling other agencies. You could only get it from sort of tracking down each little piece. It is hard to remember that pre-Google time, even for those of us who've lived long enough, but it's...
I was watching a documentary not too long ago that one of the real obstacles to law enforcement catching, in this case, it was a serial killer in Manhattan, was that, you know, the police department's databases didn't talk to each other. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you've got someone committing a crime in Manhattan, literally across the river in New Jersey, if the same type of crimes are being committed, there's no way that the police at the time could compare those, link those. They couldn't talk to each other. You had to either happenstance know someone there or read it in the newspaper. Whereas now, obviously, because of this, that all pops up, you know, whether it's motives or this sort of insignia on the body or the weapon of choice, or, you know, all of these specifics, I would imagine, of crimes are tied into this. You know, where did it occur? How did it occur? What was the murder weapon? Well, you know, all of these things have a very useful application, obviously, to law enforcement, but also a very dramatic influence in taking away any sort of privacy rights from individuals.
That's certainly obviously a concern people had early on with this, but it's important to realize too, there's sort of an end run here, because obviously Asher was not a cop. He was a private company, and his company was going to the state of Florida for the most part, eventually other states, eventually counties and everybody else, and pretty much getting every public record. And in a state like Florida that has a laudably open government and always had, it made it easy hunting for someone like Asher, who could pull these databases and pull this information that no one ever thought of. No one ever conceived of a computer that could take all of this and paint a picture pixel by pixel in the way that Asher could. They just thought, well, this is a public record. It should go to them. And the law was written to back that up. And Asher had good attorneys. And so the end run that's happening here is that government records are being sold to a private company and then being tapped into by government law enforcement in a way that they wouldn't be able to do in their own systems. They're going to this private company to do what the government, in some cases constrained by the Fourth Amendment, can't do. And that, mm-hmm. especially once you get to the federal level, becomes a very important thing, is that it's, someone called it Big Brother's Little Helper. But it it's absolutely true that it, for the people I talked to who were working on these abducted children cases, they could just, they'd never solve them quickly enough. And time really mattered. And suddenly they could. And they had nothing but gratitude to Asher for that. Eventually, the privacy aspect, the fact that any of us could be looked up, and that a private company or eventually companies had not just our recent records, but now 30 years of our history, takes on a different light. If you know where someone's been and how their life has been for that many years, you can predict a lot more about their future.
There's a certain comedy, too, in the book. I love the repeated scenes where first using AutoTrack and then later using Accurate. Like Hank is giving a demo and he asks, what's your name? And he looks them up and finds out something embarrassing about them. You know, it turns out this guy's wife had been married before and he didn't know.
things like that. They would go to these trade shows, right? The sheriff's trade shows, the eventually the international chiefs of police trade show. And they would just, that's all they'd have to do. They would just set up this big screen. They would have to pick out certain planes because the screen was like a 50-inch screen and you couldn't fit it in the cargo bay in some plane. So they have to really do some research on which flight was which. Mm-hmm. They would go to these trade shows. They would set this big screen up and they would just wait for people to run their name. You know, of course, as soon as I heard about this technology, I ran my own in these systems that he built. Like, who wouldn't? It's like Googling yourself, but even more. And so, yeah, all these cops would come up and they would run their own name and then they would swear and then they would sign up. It was just that easy. She said, his main salesperson Lee McMorrow said, it was just, you didn't have to do anything. You would just set it up and then you would sign up everybody there. They would never see anything like it, and it blew their minds. And that went on probably for 10 years where they were just signing up police department after police department.
Jump forward to today. Where else do we see the application of this technology, with which makes him, you know, the most important person no one's ever heard of?
Most of the Fortune 500 companies use his technology. Almost every law enforcement agency of the 18,000, including federal and state. The CIA and NSA have used supercomputers that his companies built, that basic design used for counterterrorism measures after 9/11. And of course, most insurance companies, most big banks. To give an example that's familiar to me, if you get challenged when you're trying to log into your bank account and said, you know, which of these addresses have you lived at? Mm-hmm. That's very often something that Asher's companies built on the one side. One of the newest applications is in healthcare. Like federal cops, their federal investigators are constrained by the Fourth Amendment and the Privacy Act. Healthcare companies are obviously constrained by HIPAA. Now, much like in the case we were talking about before, you can learn a lot about someone, not just from their health records, not just from their police records, but by sort of the public records that show their situation. And to give one example that was really salient during the height of the COVID lockdown, it was, have you lived in a place that had a lot of pollution? Because that can end up meaning respiratory ailments. And so you can take someone's address history and you can see, oh, look, they grew up poor. They grew up in this neighborhood that had a lot of particulate matter and that still does. And then you could write an algorithm that would say, okay, this person, they live in a house that's not valued very much in a neighborhood that has very little public transit and it's kind of a food desert. And it looks like they grew up poor. It looks like they live alone, so they don't have anyone to take themselves to the hospital. You could even at this point see their media diet. Looks like they get all their news from Facebook as opposed to, say, the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. And you can start building this profile of someone that's not at all from their health information, but is very relevant to their health outcomes. And so there were companies, not Asher's exactly, but there were companies using data sets that came from Asher's companies, building algorithms at the height of the pandemic when there was a ventilator shortage, saying that, hey, hospitals, if you can't decide who should get the ventilator, here's a way to do a bit of triage. If you can't decide who to throw your resources into, here's a way to do some triage.
Well, and that leads itself to all sort of troubling racial profiling, economic profiling. If you stick someone's zip code in and that's a poor zip code, which reads black zip code, which reads maybe this person shouldn't get that loan, or the loan percentage should be higher than the white person who lives in this zip code who went to college. That's where this becomes highly problematic to use an overused word, because the application of it can I guess, fill in for just abject racial bias.
Speaking of, the part of the book that made my eyebrows go bing was about the 2000 election. Hank's role in that. Please tell that story.
Yeah, it's important to say that by the time his computers were involved and his company was involved in the 2000 election, he himself was gone from that company. That was Database Technologies. And he had his cocaine runner past had come to light. And of course, he was kind of a maniac and running the company. So he'd been sidelined after Ken Langone, the billionaire we've all heard of, kind of stepped in and took over, and he kicked Hank out. And one of the things that happened after Asher was at this company and the others is that he kind of decided what the company should use this data for. And he didn't want them to do marketing, for instance, but it was all about his whims. And after that, it was just this product that a corporation was selling, and they had different guidelines. You know, they certainly wouldn't do some things that Asher might do, but they did things like this, which was get into trying to clean the voter rolls and the welfare rolls and use this data to show that certain people who are signing up for government benefits or to vote shouldn't be. And of course, after the Miami mayoral election, where there was actual fraud, I think that was what, 98?
Yeah.
So there was a real push, and it was a bipartisan push at the time, to make sure that the dead people weren't voting in Florida, and that convicted felons should not be voting at the time. That was the understanding. And they put out a sort of an RFP and took all these bids for someone who could build the system to do that. And lo and behold, Database Technologies put in a bid. Somehow they knew exactly how much money the state budget had allocated for this project. And they hit that mark exactly. And they put in the highest bid, and they got it. And they started building a system to clean the voter rolls. And I think there has not been as much attention on what happened with that, because in every county, everyone got this list of voters who should not be there and or who should not be actually voting, because they were claimed to be either felons or dead. And that included people who had felonies in other states. Now, in one version of that list, they kind of messed up and they included people who had misdemeanors as well as felonies. That was just a mistake in the programming. They just didn't perfectly fuse the data. That was just something that happened. And so all these people who maybe they did have a misdemeanor, or they'd had a felony, but it had been expunged, or it had otherwise been pushed away, were suddenly told they couldn't vote. That's on one side. And then that was sort of a problem. But then also the state pushed Database Technologies to loosen the matching algorithm. If you can imagine that, to go back to the Chad Scott example, let's say we've got Chad B. Scott, we've got Chad with 1D Scott, we've got Chad with 3D Scotts. You could decide that all of those are the same person with some fidelity, or you could say they're not a perfect match, and so we're going to exclude these two. And when the state first got the lists from Database Technologies, they didn't have that many matches. They were sort of disappointed that they'd spent all this money on this computer system, and really they didn't find that much fraud. They didn't find many felons who shouldn't be voting. They didn't find that many people who were otherwise ineligible. And so they said, you know, maybe you should loosen the match, take it from 99% fidelity to 90 to 80. And then in the various counties, you know, the election officials can go through and verify. So at least you give them a longer list, and then they'll shorten it themselves. That was the directive. And what happened was, in some cases, that list was sent to the counties, and they didn't do any further verification, and all these people were not allowed to vote. And overwhelmingly, the people kicked off the rolls incorrectly, of which there were some estimates are in the tens of thousands.
Oh my gosh.
The vote margin, of course, was 538 votes in the final count between Bush and Gore. And the people were overwhelmingly Black. The Black voters at the time were overwhelmingly Democrats. And by most, you know, do the math, and it seems like it could have swung the election. Had this algorithm not gone awry, Gore would have been president and not Bush.
Wow. Before we wind up, I want to make sure you tell folks the story about Hank and what happened with 9/11.
Hank Asher had a new company right when 9/11 happened. It was called Seisint. It was basically like his previous one, database technologies, but with more information, email addresses. Now it had credit card information, not your transactions necessarily, but all the stuff, the address history. And they just all the new information that they wouldn't have had in the early 90s and did have by early 2000. All the internet stuff that was coming online, even IP addresses. They had information from UPS, so that if they tapped into that, they could see who was shipping packages to other people. I think they had some information from Blockbuster Video. To what degree they were getting what you were checking out, I don't know. But they just had, there was so much more information already. It was growing day by day and year by year. And they introduced this new computer system and this new product called Accurint, which blew the old product out of the water. And they were starting to go around to the same sheriff's conferences and the same police conferences to sell this to people when 9/11 happened. And Asher was there in the office. Apparently they all clustered around and watched the towers come down. And then he just said to everybody in the room, call everyone you know in law enforcement. Access to the product is free. Give them whatever they need. Let's go. And then he went home and he started thinking about what more he could do. And he built, he took this algorithm and tweaked it to run through all the databases they had and start assigning what they called the high terrorist factor or the terrorism quotient to individuals. Try to give everyone a score in this database to see how likely they were connected to the attacks. And some of the things they were searching for was, I mean, it was profiling. It was a young Muslim male recently arrived in the country. And a lot of it was also very smart. It was about shared address history, of course, with some of the known hijackers. It was looking at eventually once they got into that UPS data, which I'm not sure they did legally, it was seeing who sent packages to people. They saw who registered credit cards on the same day. Looked at all these shared addresses. They could see, you know, if someone had gotten a driver's license at the same place on the same day as this other person who also had a similar name and age profile. So they started scoring all of America.
And all of America.
Everyone in their databases would have gotten some sort of score. You would have been run through. And then they came up with these lists. And there were lots of lists. There was one with 120,000 names that were big enough to show up on this list, let's say, a high enough terrorism quotient or high terrorist factor that they would show up on this list. And then they had the 1% list, which was 1,200 names. And on that 1% list were five of the 9/11 hijackers. And even when he ran it a couple days after 9/11, they came up with at least, I think, one of the hijackers' names. And so they were onto something. They presented this to the Secret Service, to the FDLE, eventually made it to the FBI. Eventually they built a whole program called the Matrix based on this. It was state sharing data with one another. And eventually their computers made it into the CIA and NSA. CIA more prolongedly than the NSA. And there are two ways to look at this. One is that he was able to do data mining and he identified the hijackers before they were publicly known, which is amazing, before their names were publicly known. And the other way to look at it is he had this list of 1,200 people and he presented it to cops, much as his previous company presented this list of people who shouldn't vote to the election officials. And when people are given a list, they start checking it. They start going down it. So that list of 1,200 people, it did have some people under active investigation. It did have some hijackers. And then it had a bunch of people who were here, maybe without documents. It had a people who were on the list who were young Muslim males who were suddenly picked up and arrested. There were stories from the jail in Brooklyn where people were held for months on end. It became a Supreme Court case over the abuses they underwent when in that detention center. And lots of people were thrown out of the country based on profiling and arrested for no reason, perhaps because of this. So it cut both ways.
Is it because people have this conception that, oh, it came from a computer, it must be right, it must be 100% accurate, which of course is not, obviously not true.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is. I think that we're seeing that now with all the AI products that the big fear is that it seems so credible when it comes from a computer. I mean, I use the example of when you follow the Google Maps or Apple Maps on your phone and it leads you this idiotic way, you trust it. Even if you know the route, you say, this is telling me to go this way. And that's what people have done now for 20 plus years with these lists spit out by computers. And I think that was the case with these lists. Even if Asher and his employees would tell investigators, they'd say, hey, this is just something the computer spit out. It could have errors. It's not perfect. We're giving you a big list so you can go do your job. The flip side of that is that as we're getting more information and able to close these cases, it gives you more people to investigate.
Sure. And even if the computers don't have these tendencies, which they may, people are lazy, people are racist,
yeah,
people abuse power. So you give someone a list of, you know, tens of thousands of names in the case of the Florida election in 2000, or a couple thousand names in the case of 9/11. Those are real people. And what the people in power, the cops or the election officials, choose to do with those names can be based totally arbitrarily, totally on race, totally on bias. The application of the data is where it becomes so dangerous. And this has really been a fascinating conversation, Mackenzie.
I just want to close with the my favorite story in the book is the one where there's a reporter, and I recognize who it is. It's Lucy Morgan, who died just it recently, was at the retirement party for the Florida Department of Law Enforcement director, Tim Moore, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And realized she was one of only two civilians at the party, and the other civilian, Tim Moore, said, "This is my best friend," and it was Hank Asher. And she's like, "Who is that guy?" And starts investigating who he is. And it turns out, oh, he's a drug smuggler.
Mm-hmm. And the FDLE knew. They had their own internal reports, and they're doing major business with this guy. Yeah. It dogged him throughout, and it dogged everyone. That's, as I reported this book, his companies, I didn't say their names, but it's LexisNexis.
Wow.
It's Thomson Reuters, and it's TransUnion. These are stodgy companies who very much don't want you to know that their roots are at this with this Coke guy, this larger-than-life smuggler
Florida
type.
This Florida man.
Yeah.
Boy.
Nobody wants to be part of his legacy, and yet I think we all are.
Amazing. Our guest has been Mackenzie Funk. The book is The Hank Show, How a House Painting, Drug Running DEA Informant Built the Machine That Rules Our Lives. Mackenzie,
what a great subhead.
Oh, man. Outstanding.
I wish I could claim credit.
Yeah.
Yes,
the book was just published this fall of 2023. So check it out. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, people wonder how their, you know, Alexa speaker, you know, knows what to say to them, or what their favorite songs are, or how these advertisements track us online about what our purchasing habits are. That's where this all came from. Amazing. A Florida guy
and using Florida records, you know, sort of abusing the sunshine law that we love so much, but, you know, turning it into this commercial enterprise that has now become sort of a nightmarish thing for us to deal with.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.